Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 19th century geologist, geographer, wilderness advocate, and mountaineer John Muir liked best to be thought of as a botanist. Wherever he walked, and he seemed to walk everywhere, from the Midwest to Florida, across California and Alaska, he collected plants. In a remarkable new book, that collection has been tracked down and photographed. It's a dazzling, sobering window on our botanical world then and now. This hour, On Point, on the trail of John Muir's botanical travels. You can join the conversation. It's spring. The season of plants is coming. Do you know what that would have looked like in your neighborhood 150 years ago? Can you picture the botany of John Muir's day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will hear in a few minutes from a botanist who's walked where Muir walked and specializes in the endangered plants of California. But first, joining me from Berkeley, California, is Bonnie Geisel. Since 2001, she's been curator of LeConte Memorial Lodge, the headquarters for the Sierra Club in Yosemite National Park. Muir founded the Sierra Club, had a lot to do with the creation of our national parks, Yosemite and more. Bonnie Geisel has tracked down many of John Muir's collected plant specimens and, along with photographer Stephen Joseph, has brought them out in a new book, Nature's Beloved Son, Rediscovering John Muir's Botanical Legacy. You can see quite wonderful collection of images from the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Bonnie Geisel, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks very much for being there today.
Hi, Tom. It's wonderful to join you.
This is just an astounding story and an astounding collection of images. He walked seemingly everywhere, and everywhere he went, he took a plant press with him and did what, Bonnie?
He remembered the world around him. He thought about new plants, plants familiar to him, collecting plants that helped him to overcome a sense of loneliness as he traveled, particularly through the South in 1866. This was a way of keeping memories, of bringing friends with him and understanding science, understanding something of the beauty of the world around him, becoming more familiar, understanding the connectedness of all of life.
John Muir lived 1838 to 1914. The son of Scottish immigrants, came with him himself from Scotland to Wisconsin, grew up on a farm there. And when did he know that he was going to set out, or how did he set out, and what became the sort of environmentalist botanist passion of his life, Bonnie?
He entered the University of Wisconsin in 1861. I was studying with Ezra Carr, a horticulturalist and agricultural chemist, but he was encouraged in the area of field botany by a fellow student, Milton Griswold, who pointed out to Muir on the stone steps of North Dormitory that there was a locust tree and it was a lot like a garden pea. And Muir was very inquisitive, keen observer, delighted in the sense of the connectedness, and took to botany, bought a copy of Alphonso Wood's class book, and ran to the fields with great joy to study God's creation.
Was working in a factory in Indianapolis, maybe, got injured there, nearly blinded. Soon after, set off on a 1,000-mile walk from Indianapolis to Florida, and what, pressing and collecting plants all the way?
He, after the eye injury, decided that he would turn away from the inventions of humanity. John Muir very likely could have been another Henry Ford. Instead, he chose to focus on the world around him, and what he knew and where he was going was in relation to the study of botany and the study of plants. He traveled through the South. What he called was a strange land. And the further south he got, the more unusual it became for him. He passed mangroves and magnolia and found the palmetto in a grassy place. And there he felt that the palmetto had more to teach him than a human priest. He turned to nature as a source of truth, of divine revelation and inspiration and imagination, and was continuing to collect, carrying his plant press with him all the way to Havana, Georgia.
That inspiration.
I mean, to Havana, Cuba.
Yeah, Havana, Cuba. Yeah, further south. That inspiration clear in all of his notes. There's this great line where he's at one point he's in an Ontario swamp in Canada, and comes on this single white flower blooming on a bed of moss, and makes a note that the beauty of this one lone, I guess it was Calypso borealis, was pure enough for the throne of its creator. He was no stranger to an almost mystical enthrallment with plants, Bonnie.
I think the Calypso was what I would call an epiphany from Muir. It not only was the sense of that he was able to actually find it, but that in the plant he could see that it was not intended for him. That here's where Muir's, what I would call his moral compass, his sense of the equality of all life, the value of all life, was that in each it was first for itself and then only for others, only for humanity to see. And so in finding the orchid, he found something of this universal glory of the fact that God as creator was a bit of a an artist, and that the beauty was in and of itself pure and by itself, and that brought him a sense of joy and a sense of opportunity.
The photographs in this book are absolutely remarkable, and listeners, if you have any way to get to the internet as we're speaking, I really encourage you to do it, onpointradio.org. These from Bonnie and Stephen Joseph's book, Nature's Beloved Son. Astonishing, beautiful photographs of the specimens that he collected. Getting hold of these specimens, tracking them down, was kind of an epic undertaking in itself. Where did they end up, and how did you track them down, Bonnie?
I'd been studying Muir and his life as a botanist for quite a while, actually. Part of my dissertation uncovered the relationship between orchids and John Muir and his mentor, Jean Carr. Their friendship continued throughout her life, and she died in 1903 when Muir was on his travels around the world. Mm. The plants were in various university herbaria and in institutions like the Missouri Botanical Garden, the American Museum of Natural History, the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. And it was a matter of rereading all of Muir's work, making lists of plants, breaking those lists down geographically, and then setting appointments and traveling to these institutions to try to locate Muir's plants. Plants are not in herbaria by the collector, they're by family, genus, and species. And so the lists were a point of departure and enabled me to try to begin to locate the plants within each one of these institutions. So it was a matter of actually going through, in some cases, a few plants piled one on top of another, and in other cases, going through hundreds to try to find John Muir's name on a particular plant specimen. When I was at Harvard, it took me about 3 days before I came upon a specimen, and those specimens were all from Alaska, collected in 1881. So sometimes it took a little bit of time in order to understand what a collection might hold.
And these plants that have been on journeys of their own, I mean, first of all, in the wild, and then in John Muir's knapsack, whatever he was carrying them in, the specimens that he first pressed, and then he would be mailing them back to, I guess, family on these treks. I'm looking here at a wonderful photograph of sea oats that, if I'm interpreting this correctly, were mailed in the envelope below from the Hotel Key West in Key West, Florida, to California. And this is sometime, I guess, in the 19th century. So they would have traveled through with the U.S. mail across the country before they ever made it to the herbarium where they ended up.
This plant was sent by Muir to his wife in 1898. He retraced his steps through the South with Charles Sargent from the Arnold Arboretum at Harvard and a man named William Canby from Maryland. And he went in many of the same places that he traveled in 1867. And so this was essentially a way for him to connect, sort of like sending a postcard. Instead of a postcard, he sends a plant.
Yeah.
That's a postcard for Muir.
From John Muir,
And so these plants would go to family and friends, connecting each to the other, and oftentimes plants were also sent to Asa Gray at Harvard, to John Redfield at in Philadelphia. So he sent plants out in a variety of ways. In fact, when he was in California, when he was in Yosemite, he sent so many incense cedar plants out that it did indeed seem like postcards. He sent them to everybody to celebrate the natural world, to celebrate the way it looked, knowing that many of them would never be able to be there. And so this was his way of connecting people and his plant friends.
It was a celebration, a kind of John Muir postcard. Was it also, did he see it? It made copious notes on all this. Did he see it as a snapshot in time, as a record of the botanical world in the years of his treks? Did he hope that these would speak to botanists years down the line? Do we know?
Well, Muir collected first because he was very inquisitive. He was looking to understand something about the world. He felt beauty was a civilizing agent. And so for him, again, the idea of connecting bits and pieces, I don't think Muir would have ever even thought that I would come along someday and try to put this all together and understand the landscape that he saw. But nonetheless, for science, that was part of it. For Muir, it was beauty. It was his own inquisitiveness. He'd stick them in his pocket. He'd put them between the pages of his journal, much like people do today. So there were a couple different things going on there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook with a little music from that time. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the journeys and botanical collection of America's, original environmentalist, John Muir. In about 60 seconds, we're going to be joined as well by a botanist who has walked some of those very trails. Let me get a call here first from Rainbow in Boston, Massachusetts. Rainbow, you're on the air.
Hi. I just want to mention the poem by John Muir. He said, "Climb the mountain and get the good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine into trees. The wind will blow you the freshness and storms you with energy, and your worry will drop off like autumn leaves." And I use this for seminar all the time to inspire scientists. And I say scientists, when they climb the mountain, means scientists discover medicine. They need good equipment, good idea, good funding, everything, just like climb the mountain.
It's wonderful.
Nature's peace. Nature means that nature is the best magazine in the world, nature. And if you get good data, you will publish Nature. And sunshine into tree, everybody will invite you to give seminar. And then you will be excited, and all your worry will drop off like autumn leaves because you will get job all over the world.
I love it, Rainbow. The wind will blow you freshness, and your worries will drop away like autumn leaves. It's great. Thank you very much for that. Bunny Geisel, there in Berkeley. I want to welcome in right now as well in Berkeley, California, Dean Taylor. He's a researcher at the Jepson Herbarium at the University of California, Berkeley, expert on endangered plants in California. He's written popular field guides on flowering plants in Yosemite and the Sierras. He's walked in John Muir's footsteps and seen some of the damage climate change is doing to plants and habitats that John Muir cataloged, also shared in some of the joy of those walks and beautiful areas. Dean Taylor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Greetings, Tom.
You may know all this like the back of your hand, but for me, looking at these absolutely marvelous specimens that Bonnie Geisel has brought back to us, I'm just amazed at the beauty, the splendor of what John Muir collected and we get to see today. You know, it should give us some sense of, you know, can we walk out now and collect the same kind of specimens, the same kind of health and vigor that John Muir collected in 1867 or 1901 or wherever he was? Is the natural world similar enough that we could bring this collection back today, Dean?
Well, first of all, we have to keep in mind that we're still exploring the biota of the world. We're still discovering new species. So, yes, plant collecting is an exercise that botanists are still doing. In fact, in John Muir's territory, the Sierra Nevada, there is, and in California, we're still discovering on the order of 3 to 5 new species a year and have been for the last several decades. Now, the secondary question is are some of the plants that Muir found still extant or still doing well? And that's a topic that we can explore.
I hope it's more than some. I hope that a lot of them are still extant and doing well. I mean, there's so many in here. They are so gorgeous. I'm looking here at wild ginger, absolutely beautiful specimen and beautifully photographed. But I mean, when you look at a collection of images like this, Dean, do these look familiar to you from your walks and travels on the same trails? Is it all still out there, or most of it?
Well, yes. We still have the components. How long we will have them is the central question to keep in mind. Remember, Yosemite, John Muir led to the creation of Yosemite National Park, essentially, and the park protects this place that he revered. But can we protect it from external forces like global warming? Climate change is another matter.
Bonnie Geisel, you live more or less half of every year in Yosemite, if I've got it right, in your work there. When you look around, do you feel as though you're looking at, I know it's not the same Yosemite. It was in fact a town when John Muir was there, and it populated in a different way than today. But in terms of the nature that you see, the botany that you see, do you feel that you're seeing a similar world, Bonnie?
Well, the valley certainly has changed since Muir was there. When he first arrived in 1868, there were probably about 500 visitors a year. By the end of the century, there were probably about 5,000 visitors a year. Today, we have over 3 million visitors a year. The impact of people coming in automobiles, RVs, motorcycles, whatever, certainly takes its toll on both flora and fauna of the valley. And the valley changes itself. I was there last weekend. There was a minor rock slide on Half Dome. Fire, you know, natural occurring fire plays a role in the changes that Yosemite National Park and the High Sierra go through on a regular basis. So there are all kinds of things involved. The carrying capacity of people, fire, climate change, as Dean mentioned, are all issues that are being discussed and consideration given to, and what can we do to lessen our human impact and look at how climate change, the lack of water, the melting glaciers will affect all life that in Yosemite Valley.
Listeners, if you can get to a keyboard, get to the Internet, by all means, check out the collection of images there from Bonnie Geisel's book, Nature's Beloved Son. Absolutely wonderful images of John Muir's collected specimens at onpointradio.org. Let's get a call from Richmond, Virginia. Lauren, you're on the air.
Hello. I am ecstatic. I'm on my way to Shenandoah National Park.
Hey,
I'm a horticulturist and master naturalist. And we're working on invasive species. I was also wondering if in her research she found any species or genus that have since become extinct or are non-native plants.
Let us look at that, Lauren, and have fun at Shenandoah. Bonnie, first to you on invasive species and their impact on the terrain that John Muir walked. Of course, it was almost everywhere in total, but maybe take California, for example.
Maybe Dean can better answer the invasive species in the
Probably Sierra. The answer mm-hmm. to the question would be neither, although we do know that John Muir saw plants that are now very rare. And he also, we do know, for example, that there are plants just even in Yosemite Valley, which we can no longer account for. So,
can you give us an example or two there?
Yes. Well, an example would be there was a fawn lily or dogtooth violets, as they're called. Mm-hmm. It's a lily. Mm-hmm. In New England today or this week, the early part of spring, they will be coming up in the woods. Mm. They're a fairly common flower, wildflower in the east, and we have species in California. There was a species of fawn lily reported from Yosemite Valley in the 1880s. Mm. There was, in fact, a specimen that was collected, and the specimen met its fate during the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. And we have not been able to relocate any members of that genus, the genus Erythronium. in Yosemite Valley in spite of searching repeated times.
Now there
so that's an example.
There are some examples which are under pressure, maybe because of climate change. In particular, you've said, Dean Taylor, alpine plants, a couple named after, maybe by and after Muir himself, that would have been trying to retreat upward to have the temperature they need and may not have much more room to travel upward.
Right. In fact, yes. John Muir, in fact, I'll start by saying that I was struck by Bonnie Geisel's book because it taught me a botanist. I'm a botanist. Mm. That John Muir was in first and foremost a botanist. We know that there are several species that are named to commemorate him, and I was aware of that. But I always thought of him more as a writer as opposed to an actual collector, and his specimen record is very profound. An example I'll relate to you is a plant, an alpine plant in John Muir's in Yosemite that grows only on the highest peaks. It's the Muir's Mousetail. Mm. It's a little tiny plant, no more than about 2 inches tall. It's in the rose family. Mm-hmm. The genus is Ivesia Muiri. And it's found only on the alpine summits. Now, it's very well known that as climate warms, ostensibly, the life zones, the alpine zone, will get warmer and warmer. And you can make actually a simple calculation that how far up in altitude you would have to go, for instance, in the Himalaya or the Sierra or any other mountain range to replicate the current climate.
To stay cool.
To stay cool, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the Northern Hemisphere, on a kind of a general basis, the alpine zone corresponds roughly to the temperature of 0 degrees centigrade or about freezing point of water.
And
that's the average annual temperature of timberline.
And because the mountains are only so high, there's only so high you can go, whether it's the mouse tail there in the Sierra Nevada or you've mentioned another Muir's daisy that he picked up in Alaska.
Right. So the Muir's Mousetail, which now grows at 11,000 feet, projecting its climate envelope to a higher to a future, let's say a century hence, would have to move to something like 15,000 feet, and that's a minor problem because the mountains aren't that high.
They're just not there. The same pressure on this rare Arctic plant, the Muir's Daisy, and I guess with that, the irony that these two plants named after him are both being kind of forced into a corner by climate change.
Right. The Muir's Daisy is found in Alaska, the Brooks Range, Cape Thompson, and the same phenomenon. We're observing that high latitude and high altitude climates are changing disproportionately fast. So isn't it ironic that both of Muir's plants are now poised, if you will, on the brink of change?
Bonnie, did John Muir have any inkling that something like that could happen? I mean, he knew that industrialization could ravage wild places and fought hard for national parks as one conservationist preserve against that. But did he have any inkling of how a whole climate might change? Under man's hand, I guess.
I don't think so, but I think that Muir wanted people to visit the mountains for reasons of health and goodwill. But I think he understood the complexity of the interaction of this relationship. And he thought that by encouraging people to get into the mountains in order that they would preserve them would eliminate the kinds of problems that he thought perhaps the world might face in the future. He was a visionary, and so the point of it all is preservation. In preserving it, in preserving wildness, he felt that in wildness lied the hope of the world. There was a balance that he appreciated, and exceptional at that. And so where he may not have understood the complexities of the relationship of climate change as we face it today, he certainly understood and appreciated and was very sensitive to these relationships and the balance.
Mm. The hope of the world in wildness. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Hatsy in Hamilton, Massachusetts. Hatsy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I cannot wait to read your book, Bonnie. It sounds marvelous. From the little that I know about the great botanical collectors of the world, from the 18th century clergymen to Banks to Chinese Wilson, they were all a little bit nuts. And their findings, in a way, benefited science only really by the way. So I'm wondering whether his personality, John Muir's personality itself, interested you and how much you go into that in your book.
Very substantially. But Bonnie, speak to that, please. This was a character sui generis.
Absolutely. It's covered throughout this book. It's also covered in a previous book that I published, Kindred and Related Spirits, The Letters of John Muir and Jean C. Carr. Jean Carr was Muir's mentor throughout his early career. And Muir was a quirky fellow. He felt that he lived beyond the boundaries of common people. He wanted to explore the world. He sort of looked into himself and asked if he could be released from common concerns of ordinary, normal people. And he reached to fit the larger universe. He wanted to find himself out there living an experience and finding that destiny, matching himself, keeping himself in tune with the sense of the created order around him. When he suffered his eye injury in Indianapolis in early 1867, Jean Carr wrote to him and said, "You have the eye within the eye to see in all natural things the power of God." I mean, she was essentially giving him the permission to become the person that he wanted to become. In 1874, when he left Yosemite, Muir spent about 40 months in Yosemite, all told, somewhat consecutively, compressed, and returned over the years following that. But when he left Yosemite in the fall of 1874, he went up toward Shasta and he climbed a tree. And he waved up there in the wind in the tree and spoke about how trees travel like humanity around the planet 2 million miles a day. He understood. He seemed to connect. He seemed to understand, intuit, that there was something special about plants, something about the world around him, and he released himself. He felt freedom when he went to Canada to study in the University of the Wilderness. He felt freedom when he was on his 1,000-mile walk, no matter how strange it was. He felt freedom when he entered into Yosemite, what I called his graduate school years, and he felt extremely empowered when he went to Alaska, what he called nature's own reservation.
See the images at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
As he cast his eyes down, "Sweet Betsy, my darling, we've come to Hangtown. Singing to rely early, I early, I to rely early."
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at the 19th century botanical journeys of the great John Muir this hour and how those trails and plants look today. Dean, you've looked into the collection that Bonnie and Stephen have put together here. I mean, these images, I just like to think about some of these. It sort of began with the honey locust, I guess, that he saw out his window in Madison, Wisconsin. He may have seen that as beautiful. I grew up with honey locusts. They were absolutely the most terrifying thorned trees, I would say, maybe in this world, just absolute impassable thickets of dark, heavy, sharp, huge thorns, Dean. Not exactly the stuff of beauty, unless you're into that piercing sort of thing, maybe.
All plants are, of course, created equal.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, that one's anybody's equal, unless you're clad in armor.
Anyone's equal. His specimens are an important component of his legacy. And, in fact, I'll relate to you. When he lived in Martinez, California, his collection came to his house. And the collection is 1,000 or 1,500 specimens, which at the time was equivalent to any of the universities in California. Of course, California until, well, you know, early in 1880s, 1890s was still a relatively remote place. The railroad had just been constructed. So he had as much of a herbarium as the University of California did.
In his own personal collection?
In his own personal collection.
Bonnie, what condition did you find these specimens in when you tracked them down to the various spots around the country you traveled?
Some places they were, I could tell that they hadn't been looked at since they were placed there. A lot of the plants collected by Muir in Yosemite and the High Sierra were at the Academy in Philadelphia. At the end of the century, they were purchased by the Missouri Botanical Garden in order to raise money for Philadelphia Academy. And they were amongst probably 16,000 plants that were purchased. They weren't purchased because they were Muir's plants. They were purchased because of the value of the specimens themselves as they represented various families, genus, and species. So when I went to Missouri, one of my last trips in 2005, I could tell that in opening these folders and finding a Muir plant, that it probably hadn't been examined in a very, very long time. Some of the plants are in better condition than others. You have to understand that in order to fasten them to a sheet of paper, they have to be glued or taped down. When Stephen went in to Photoshop, he would remove the glue and tape. It would take anywhere from 6 to 20 hours for a normal plant, if you can call any plant normal, and it took him 40 hours to do the Washington lily to remove all the glue and tape
out of the image, so that we could see the specimen kind of in its original glory.
Exactly, Stephen was trying to restore them to look the way they looked when Muir last saw them. So they're in various conditions. Obviously, as I said, many of these collections, I had to go one by one to find them at the John Muir National Historic Site. They had Muir specimens from Canada and Indiana. At the University of the Pacific in the Holt-Atherton collection, they had the plants collected by Muir, some of the plants attributed to Muir from various periods of time. So they're in different conditions at different institutions. Collections, as I said, deal with family, genus, and species. I was looking at this from the perspective of one collector. How did John Muir understand the landscape? What did he see when he traveled through Yosemite or through Canada? And so it was a unique perspective on understanding and studying the history of plant collecting.
You mentioned the Washington lily, a gorgeous, fragrant plant in Yosemite, but also a favorite for people to pluck and take away, Bonnie, I guess, in Muir's time and more recently.
Well, the Washington lily today lives in a few pockets that I know of along 140 near Glacier Point Turnoff. They spring up in June, and they're maybe 6 feet tall, and they have beautiful white fragrant flowers. But in the 19th century, this was a very much sought-after bulb. Jean Carr, as a matter of fact, in 1869, when she arrived in the valley and could not find Muir because he was up with the sheep above Yosemite Falls, came down into the valley on the back of a mule with Washington lily bulbs woven together, braided around her shoulder. And these were a treasure. This was a harvesting that, for good reason, and fortunately, is not undertaken today in the national parks. You take only pictures, you leave only footprints, and you don't take any plants with you. But the Washington lily has suffered a fate of its sheer beauty. Even though in many pockets, as Muir wrote, it lived in the sugar pine woods, which is at an elevation of about 1,000 feet higher than the valley, it still was subjected to over-harvesting and suffers today from the lack of, the lack of thriving because of that. There are other plants that have suffered the same experience. The orchid, the Lady Slipper Mountain Lady Slipper, was over-harvested by people. These plants, probably the Washington lily better than the orchids, and Dean could answer this better than I, but the orchids have very limited opportunity for growth. They like their habitats. And when they're removed from the park, they do not thrive.
Dean, the lady slipper orchid, the one that first inspired him so movingly in some of what he first wrote, I mean, you can find that around the country. Even in the Midwest growing up, it was a rare and wonderful occurrence when we would come across one. But we did. in the corners of farmland where I grew up. It was absolutely stunning. Still out there? This is the one he called a plant so full of life, so perfectly spiritual, it seemed pure enough for the throne of its creator.
Yes, the Calypso is a circumboreal northern hemisphere plant. It is nowhere common, widely distributed. It's not considered to be endangered. And in fact, it's never been found in Yosemite, but only in the far latitudes to the north. But there are other orchids. The Cypripedium, the lady slipper orchid, is another that Bonnie described. It's a type of plant that tourists would pick. When tourists come to Yosemite, it's a common thing for them to remark about. There's a plant called the snow plant, which is a very vibrant, ruby red, succulent, about a foot tall, that looks kind of like a how would you describe it? It's almost looks like a mushroom or asparagus, and visitors will commonly pluck them, not knowing, of course, that that is verboten.
Yeah. Let's go to Roger in Boston. Roger, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
When I was a young lad growing up in California in the 1950s, I visited Sequoia National Park. And I remember visiting a site, the site of an old fallen redwood tree, which was alleged to have been hollowed out and used as a shelter by John Muir. Hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk about his travels through the redwood forest.
Yes, thanks. Bonnie Geisel, what can you say to that?
I don't think Muir would have hollowed out a sequoia giganteum. Those trees probably fell centuries ago. And in some cases, they were hollowed out by fire. And so he may have turned one of them, still upright, into a bit of a cabin when he was there. Muir's first travel into Sequoia area, Sequoia Kings Canyon area, in 1873, following several trips into the High Sierra Tuolumne above Yosemite. He then veered south with Albert Kellogg from the Academy of Natural Sciences in September 1873, and that was his first experience there. He did return, however, in 1875 on his own, and that is probably the turning point in Muir's life when he began to write about preserving forests. That first publication appeared the following year in 1876. It was called God's First Temples. And Muir in the Sequoia Kings Canyon area came upon mills that were cutting sequoia. And sequoia is extremely brittle wood. When it falls, it shatters into pieces like glass and is not of any use for anything but toothpicks and shake shingles. And this was devastating for Muir. These trees were thousands of years old, in some cases 3,000 or perhaps 4,000 years old. And this was injustice, as I spoke earlier about the sense of valuing of, equitable life is of all value, each for its own first. And so this is a very important time in his life as he reflects, as he begins to understand what his role and responsibility will be in terms of advocating on behalf of the protection of forest and wilderness everywhere.
Let's get a call from Andy in Elmore, Vermont. Andy, you're on the air.
Hi. There's been a lot of discussion about flowering plants, but I'm really interested in primitive plants. And I'm wondering if Muir collected things like bryophytes and ferns and mosses and those sorts of things as well.
Absolutely. I'm looking at some lovely spleenwort here. And Bonnie, can you speak to that, the range of what he collected?
Oh, Muir collected ferns extensively everywhere he went. He collected them in Canada. We have maidenhair ferns. He collected them in California. We have a Polypodium californicum in the book. He collected the resurrection fern when he was in Bonaventure Cemetery in Savannah, Georgia. I actually somewhat recently found a plant that he collected in Australia. When Muir traveled around the world in 1903 and 1904, most of the collecting was done in botanical gardens, which didn't interest me as much as his collections in the wild. But recently at the University of the Pacific, I found a small maidenhair fern that he collected in Australia in 1903. So ferns make up an extensive part of Muir's collection. They were easy to recognize. He actually probably began his studies of botany when he was at the University of Wisconsin as a student studying ferns. songs. It was very popular at the time. There was this sense of the sort of prehistoric past. They had great longevity to them. There was a popularity. They were easy to recognize in the wild. And so they became a very important part of Muir's collection of plant specimens.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Emily in Boston. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I hear you and your guests talking a lot about the contributions that John Muir made in botany and the ways that the environments have changed since he studied them. And I was wondering if your guest discusses in her book one of the most important changes in the environment is that in the environments that he studied is that there are no more Native Americans there because he fought very hard to get them kicked out.
Bonnie Geisel, how about it? There certainly were in the Yosemite area when John Muir arrived, but what about Native Americans and his view of them in Yosemite and beyond? I mean, he was very keen on the plants. What about the people?
Yosemite, when Muir helped to establish Yosemite National Park in 1890, that was not part of the agenda. The removal of Native Americans from Yosemite was certainly much more politically motivated by others rather than Muir, as the park took on its place as a place set aside in perpetuity for all American people, and now it's a World Heritage Park. Muir, and I know this is a very sensitive question, looked upon the Native Americans, the park in Yosemite Valley at the time, much like others did. I don't want to separate him out or single him out as somebody who had some axe to grind or was particularly concerned about their living in the Awanichi Biwak, living in the valley at the time that he was visiting the park. Whereas I understand the question in terms of a sensitivity toward the removal of the Awanichi Miwok, I also know that as Muir matured and as anthropology and sociology became more part of our vernacular, by the time Muir was in Alaska from 1879, he took 7 trips there over a period of 20 years, that his understanding and appreciation for the spirituality and the lives and the artifacts of the native peoples in the far north was much more sensitive than other people around him. When Edward Curtis, who was the ethnophotographer on the Harriman expedition in 1899, was taking pictures of the people on board the ship in a village, Muir was not part of that photograph. He was extremely concerned about the removal of native artifacts. This is a period of time where we're growing as a nation in terms of understanding the differences of people and the importance of different ethnic groups and their contributions to the culture of America. So whereas he may not have been sensitive, I don't want to single him out as being unlike other people who were just ignorant and did not have enough appreciation and understanding.
Emily, thanks, though, for the question. It's fascinating to think of these side by side. Dean Taylor, our time grows short. When you walk these trails today, do you ever wish you could walk them with John Muir, see them as he saw them, or perhaps you still do?
I would dearly love to know where some of the plants that he collected came from. In fact, one of the plants named for Muir, Rolardiopsis muiri, or Muir's sunflower, we have not been able to, again, relocate in Yosemite. Yosemite is probably the most visited national park on Earth, yet we still can't find where that plant grows in the park.
We have John Muir more or less described to us in a book called Zanita, Tale of the Yosemite by Teresa Yelverton. And she describes him as dressed in tattered trousers, the waist eked out with a grass band, held up by hay rope suspenders with a long flowering sedge rush stuck in the solitary buttonhole of his shirt. That was a novel, but maybe she captured him. Bonnie, you just got a few seconds here, but your picture of the mind of Muir walking through this botanical garden of wonders, when you look back on it in the work of this book?
It's reflective. It's visionary. It helps to set us in our own time and our own pace. I think we can look at this book and be introspective about our own lives, our own relationship with the natural world. Learn to appreciate it more, care about it more, see plants as our family. He called plants plant friends. let's move in that direction. Let's value more the world we live in. And remember that plants are a source of inspiration, of beauty, of food.
All that. Bonnie Geisel, Dean Taylor, thank you so much for being with us. The book is Nature's Beloved Son. See images at our website, onpointradio.org. They are terrific. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.